Thank you, Mr. Yost. You were recently in China, weren't you? No, I wouldn't want to talk about that. Happy Sabbath, everyone.
Happy Sabbath.
Wow, it's great to see everybody again. It's a real joy to be back here. It's been about a year and a half since we were last here, and you all look the same. It's amazing. Nobody ages here. Mr. Pennelly's been really good to you, hasn't he? Of course, he has a few more gray hairs, I noticed. The only ones who have changed are the kids. Your children have multiplied, seemingly, before my eyes. They've grown probably 6 to 12 to 18 inches in some cases, and that's a good thing. It's nice to see our children growing up, but it's fantastic to be here. It's good to be back in Oregon. I want to bring you greetings from the congregations that I now pastor in Northern California, Redding, California, Stockton, California, and Sacramento, California. We have three congregations there that we look after, and we enjoy living in California, but we do miss Oregon. And we were reminded, we flew in to Oregon, and we flew through some bumpy weather and came down through the clouds and noticed the green hills, the green mountains, all the water. And we said, wow, don't you miss the Northwest? And of course, most of you know, Linda was born here and she misses the Northwest from time to time. So we're getting our little fix while we're here. But we do miss the mountains, the greenery, the evergreens in California. Before we had our recent rains, it was very dry, drought-stricken. We're rationing water in the state of California. We all have to reduce our water consumption by 25 to 30%, depending on what town you live in. So it's refreshing to be here in the great Northwest. Of course, we miss all of you. Among the things that we do miss from here, it's, as I said, good to see you all, and we were glad to say hello to a number of you and kind of catch up this morning and during the lunch break. One thing I really miss about Oregon, too, is the inexpensive gas. It's one of the first things I noticed when we had our rental car coming out of the airport. I go, look at the gas! It's $1.79! Guess what I paid in California 4 days ago? $2.79. So it's $1 a gallon more expensive. And I used to feel sorry for myself in California, and then I went to Israel. And Israel is about $7 a gallon for gas. So it's all a matter of perspective, I guess, but I do miss inexpensive gas in Oregon. And I also miss somebody else pumping my gas. But anyway, there's some things about Oregon that we really miss. You know what I miss? We passed by the Salvation Army gift store or thrift store the other day, and I miss the thrift stores in Oregon. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but Linda and I used, that was our hobby. You know, some people go to movies. We went to thrift stores. That was what we did for entertainment. And Oregon has this mentality of recycling everything. You know, we just recycle it, Martha, recycle it. But in California, they throw everything away. So you go to the thrift stores there, and you either have to pay a real high price, like a retail price, for anything that's there, or it's gone. But here, we were able to collect a lot of junk from the thrift stores. We moved to California, and that's one thing we miss is a big house. We moved from 3,400 square feet, and we now live in a condominium a little over 1,000 square feet. And we had to get rid of all that junk. We're very thankful that our daughter bought a house about the same time we moved into a condominium, and she took all of our furniture. So that helped somewhat, but we still have probably a little too much in our house, and we're still going through the pain of downsizing. Makes it easy, though. Used to be able to yell for Linda and her not to hear me, but now she's right next to me, it seems. We're making the adjustment to California. It's because of the cost of housing, of course, that we are making those adjustments. I might just mention before I get into the sermon that we have downsized into a 55-plus community. which is kind of interesting for me. Linda doesn't qualify, but she came in on my coattails. I keep reminding her of that. And we moved there in May, and she kept going to the pool, and they kept carting her at the pool. Because they think, you're not 55, so let's see your resident card. So she had to keep producing her resident card to get into the pool. But living in a 55-plus community is like living in an episode of Saturday Night Live. It's so amusing. Everywhere you go, about two or three times a day you hear the ambulance come into our community and you go, there goes another one. You know, it's just one of those things. Like I said, it's like a Saturday night skit. Not too long ago we went to the post office, and of course most of the patrons in the post office, even though it's right outside the gates of the community, are beyond 55 plus. And several of us are waiting in line for the next postal agent, and a lady brought in a box, and you could tell it had masking tape on it, but it wasn't very well done. And the postal agent said, you're going to have to rewrap that. You're going to have to retape it. And you can see the look on this lady's face. You know, she's probably 80 or so, and she goes, and the agent said, well, here's tape. You know, just go over there to the table, and you can tape it. So I was kind of looking with some amusement. I wonder how this is going to go. And she walked over to the table, and she took off the masking tape. And then you could tell when she tore off the tape from the tape dispenser that it was going to be very amusing, because she got it stuck to her sweater as she tore it off. And then she was trying to get it off of her sweater and over to the box. And, of course, she's got this built-in audience. We're all in line at the post office watching her. She finally gets it off her sweater and gets it half on the box, and it doesn't quite fit, so she has to tear it off, and she pulls another one off, careful not to get on her sweater, but it gets on her hair now, so she's got the tape in her hair. I mean, this went on for probably 10 minutes. It was painful. But she finally was offered a little help, got the box done, and she was laughing by the time it was all over. Of course, all of us were laughing along with her, or at her, as the case may have been. But I've got a million stories. I told Linda, who is a journalism major, that she should write a book about living in a 55-plus community. A lot of you have a lot to look forward to someday, let me tell you. Well, many of you were here this morning, and we appreciate your attendance. Our theme at the Young Adult Leadership Weekend is, will he really find faith and standing strong in a faithless world? And I think it's been very helpful to have a number of seminars and the interactive session we had this morning before lunch. Well, that was after lunch, wasn't it? The talk about this subject of faith has really allowed us, I think, to bore down a little bit and to think about it more deeply than we normally would. And I really appreciate the attendance of the congregation who are not young adults, because I think it's faith building to experience these kinds of things. Some of you may have heard about the young man who went hiking on Mount Hood. There are many trails on Mount Hood, and he was enjoying his hike during the summer. And as he ascended up Mount Hood, he noticed as he got closer and closer to the top, the trail got thinner and thinner and smaller and smaller. And the fall off on the side of the trail got more precipitous and steep. He was trying to be careful, but after all, he was a young man, and sometimes young men feel that they're invincible. And as he was climbing up this trail, he noticed that he was just about to leave the tree line and get into the shale that is common in volcanic mountains. And he noticed that the trail was a little unstable in spots, so he made a little bit of extra effort to stay close to the slope of the mountain. But as he came around one corner, he noticed that the trail narrowed down to just a few inches. and his foot stepped on some shale that was slippery, and he began to slide off the trail and down the slope. And it was fairly steep. And as he slid down the slope, he tried to grab onto anything to save him from falling. But as he ran to the edge of the slope, he realized the slope fell off of a cliff. He began to panic, and he looked up very quickly before he was about to fall off the edge of the cliff, and he saw a young sapling. And he reached out and grabbed for it, hoping it would hold his weight. And just as he grabbed for it, his feet went over the edge of this slide that went down a cliff, and he looked down below, and it fell off several hundred feet. And he was holding on with one hand on this little sapling. And he was praying, I hope this thing doesn't tear out. This evergreen, and we all know evergreens don't have deep roots, was the only thing between him and death. As he held on to that sapling, he began to think about his options. What would he do? What would he do? He thought, I can't climb back up this shale slope because it's almost as slippery as ice. What can I do? I don't want to fall, naturally. What can I do? The only thing he could think of was to hope that someone was coming up the trail and would hear him if he began to yell out. So he began to yell out, help! Help! Is there anyone up there? Help! He didn't know how long he could hang on, but he just kept repeating his plea to help. Help me! Please help me! Is there anyone else up there? Is there anybody there? He kept asking. He heard some pebbles begin to fall, and he thought, somebody's walking on the trail. He cried out again, help! Help me! Save me! As he was holding on to the sapling. And nobody was there. It was probably some of the shale that he had caused to come loose. Finally, he yelled out with all of his might, help! Help! Is there anybody there? Knowing that he couldn't hang on much longer. And finally, a voice, a deep voice out of nowhere, almost like out of heaven, said, do you have faith? And he said, yes. Yes, I have faith. Just save me. Please save me. And the voice said, do you have faith? He said, yes, yes, I have faith. And the voice said, let go. And the man thought for a moment, and he looked around, and he said, is there anybody else up there? Faith is a very big subject, isn't it? Let's bore down and dig deep into this subject of Christian faith today. What I would like to do is cover the basics first, then dig deeper and make it relevant to us in the 21st century. Let's begin with this basic question, and I know it was touched upon by Mr. Franks very briefly, but I want to, as I mentioned, bore down a little more deeply. Let's go to Hebrews, the faith chapter, Hebrews 11, commonly called the faith chapter, because it discusses this very important topic of faith. Hebrews 11, 1. In case you may have guessed, that was not a true story, by the way. Hebrews 11, 1. Paul, the author, and I believe he is the author, and I think even as I expound on this scripture, you'll agree with me in some of the analogies he makes. Hebrews 11, 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. A very challenging verse, as Mr. Franks mentioned this morning, that is sometimes hard to understand. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. It's what we hope for but cannot see. But faith produces an evidence in those things we cannot see. Interesting expression in the original Greek. It really is a nautical term. And of course, Paul, being from the Mediterranean area, the Aegean Sea in particular, having been born in the town of Tarsus, which is on the southern coast of Turkey, knew about sailing and knew about ships. He knew all about nautical terms. Everywhere he went, he sailed because it was much more safe and sometimes faster than going by land. He would often sail from his home in Tarsus to other major ports like Ephesus and then down to what today is Tel Aviv. Just north of there is Haifa, where he probably sailed to travel up to Jerusalem. So he was very well aware of these nautical terms. The nautical term refers to the confidence that a sailor would have in dropping an anchor. Let me give you an example. I have sailed sailboats. In fact, I taught sailing at our summer camp in Minnesota for several years once we gave up our skiing program, which is another interesting story. But we had small sailboats, and they were 14-and-a-half footers, and we were teaching young people, teenagers, how to sail. And they seemed to enjoy the experience, probably not as much as skiing, but they enjoyed sailing. It was a lot cheaper to pay the insurance on sailboats than ski boats. Again, I want to tell you the story, but I don't have time, so I'll move right along. We also did some fishing. We had these little fishing boats, and we'd go fishing on Orr Lake, where we had the camp. And when you found a really good spot that you thought you were going to be able to catch fish in, you would drop an anchor over the edge to hold your spot. And when you dropped that anchor, about 2 or 3 feet down in the water, it would disappear. But every time I dropped it off the side of the boat, I knew it would hit the bottom. I just knew that. If you're a sailor and you come close to an island or into a bay and you wanted to drop anchor, you had a good confidence that you could drop that anchor over the edge of the ship, and as the chain went out, sooner or later it was going to grab hold of the bottom. You had confidence in that. And that's what this expression is talking about. In Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for. You hope there's a bottom down there, and you rarely didn't find the bottom when you put the anchor off the side of the boat. It was there. You had confidence in that. You knew the anchor was going to hit the bottom. And when it hit the bottom, it was evidence of things that you didn't see, because normally the anchor falls far below the ship, and you don't see that it grabs onto the bottom. You don't see where it grabs on. You don't see the rocks that it grabs onto or the sea bottom. It just, you don't see it. But you know it's there. It's holding the ship. You're not drifting back out to sea. It is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. That's what faith is. The NASB says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. The Moffat translation says, now faith means that we are confident of what we hope for, convinced of what we do not see. Christianity is made up on the belief that we are assured of a supreme being that none of us have ever seen. And we summarize that by saying that is our faith. It's what we believe in. Our faith is believing in a supreme creator being that we have never seen. So indeed, our faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, you and I know, and you can read Romans 8, where it tells us all you have to do is walk into the creation, walk through the forest around Mount Hood or any of these mountains around here, and you will see the evidence of God in the design of the earth. We see that in nature around us. We see it in everything from geology to the smallest leaf. We say, yeah, there's a common designer here. There had to be someone to create that, as we heard in some of the summaries regarding faith this morning. Second question I'd like to raise, it's very basic, is why do we need faith? Why do we need faith? Let's go down to verse 6, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. But without faith, It is impossible to believe, to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Once again, a very succinct verse telling us that we must have faith in order to please God. We must believe that he is, that he exists, and secondarily, that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. There's really a lot packed into this verse. I think we obviously know we must have a belief in God's existence, but also that he rewards those who diligently seek him. What we're talking about today is how do we build the kind of faith that represents the diligent seeking of God. I'd like to share with you this afternoon 3 points on what it means to diligently seek him so that we can build the kind of faith that pleases God. How do we diligently seek him with the kind of faith that pleases God? Point number one, we must set our hearts on spiritual things. Number one, we must set our heart on spiritual things. God wants us to think about and to meditate on spiritual things. And the first thing we would think about is God, right? As I mentioned before, the greatness of God, God's creation. And oftentimes I've found that I can think about spiritual things when I go into nature. I love hiking. Linda and I do that quite often. In the community we live in now, which is in a kind of a three-sided canyon, they have many hiking trails, and we frequently hike the trails for exercise in our community. And we thoroughly enjoy it. And when we get out into nature, one thing we found, we live in the town called Walnut Creek, which is about 45 minutes immediately east of San Francisco. And if you come across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco, you'll be in the town of Oakland. And if you go over the Oakland Hills, very expensive real estate there, by the way, because it has a view of San Francisco and Golden Gate Bridge and all that beauty that's there. You go over those hills, the Oakland Hills, and you come to a little valley, and that's where Walnut Creek is. Walnut Creek, Lafayette, Danville, some of those little towns that are far enough away from the city and yet close enough, you know, to provide you a little privacy but still get into some culture and other things in the city. We enjoy hiking and we can see God in nature. Let's go to James 1, verse 17. James 1, verse 17. I'd like to draw your attention to something. I think it's important for us to meditate on God's faithfulness. Since we're talking about faith, what about God's faithfulness and his promises? Faith, of course, is trust that God will do as he promised. James 1, verse 17. James 1, verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. The scenery that we enjoy, the beauty of Oregon, the Northwest, even the beautiful San Francisco Bay in many ways, was originally created by God. Everything that we enjoy, from human life to the ability to think more than the animals to the ability to understand God, comes from God. Every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. I don't know if you've thought about these terms, but I looked into them a little bit in preparation for this message. The Father of lights, what lights are being talked about? The sun, the moon, and the stars. I think probably everyone here would just loves the experience of sitting down or maybe lying down as we do at camp. We take the campers out and we lay them down on the basketball court. Everybody brings a sleeping bag and we lay down and we look up at the skies. And when you're that high in the Sierras, there's very little to obstruct your view of the stars and the moon. It's a beautiful sight. One of the things that Linda and I really like about our feast site in Hawaii is when you're on the island, the Big Island, north of Kona, they have a light regulation where they don't allow lights in the parking lots, unless they've got big shades on them that point the light down and not, doesn't allow it to go up. So you have a better vista of the stars. And you can actually see the Milky Way from the Big Island of Hawaii. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. In fact, we were with someone there for dinner, and on his iPad, he had programmed the skies, and when you hold the iPad up towards the constellations, it would point out what they were, and it's got music in the background, and it's telling you what stars you're looking at. As you pan it around, it's got music in the background. It was really nice to have at the dining table. Somebody's panning this iPad around. We were being able to identify all those constellations and stars that we were able to see. And one thing that fascinated me is we went to a museum not too long ago. We took our grandson. It's a planetarium museum, and they ask questions on the video when you come into the museum. And then there's a black pause, and you kind of think of the answer, and then the answer pops up. It's kind of interesting, teachable moment. And a question popped up on the screen that drew my attention immediately. It says, how many stars are there in the heavens? I thought, oh, that'd be interesting to find out what the answer is. And I waited. The screen went black, and I waited. And it popped up, and it says, there are as many stars in the heavens as there are grains of sand on the earth. Think about that for a minute. There are as many stars in the heavens as there are grains of sand on the earth. It's almost mind-boggling to think about that, isn't it? Because when we look up into the skies, we only see a fraction of what really exists out there. And yet, to us, that's magnificent. He is the Father of lights, the Father of the stars, the sun, and the moon. Now, as I said, I thought about this a little bit. In following up on the definition of what faith is, probably in what, about an hour, maybe a little more, the sun will go down, ending our day, right? Sabbath. How sure are you that that sun is going to go down? Pretty sure, aren't you? It's the substance of things hoped for. But if the sky is cloudy, they're predicting rain tonight, and you can't see the sun go down, do you think it goes down? How do you feel about that? Do you know it's going to go down? Do you have confidence it's going to go down? Of course. The sun rising and falling each day makes our day, right? Daylight and night is separated, as it said in Genesis 1. We have confidence in that. We have faith in that. Who created that confidence in us? By his creation of the lights. God did. Now, what about the moon? The moon circulates around the earth, right? Every 30 days, right? Do you have confidence in that? I hope so, because our holy day calendar and the way we keep the annual Sabbath is based upon the circulation of the moon. We have confidence in that. In other words, God has set us an example of faithfulness in what he has created. And we see that, and we understand this principle. We don't see the moon when it goes around, you know, the black side of the earth. You don't have to say, well, I wonder if the moon is going to go on vacation. I wonder if the moon's going to flake out on us. No, it's still there. The sun is going to be there, right? We have confidence in that. That should in itself give us faith in God. He created it. He created it to be dependable. He created it to be faithful. Notice this other expression, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Once again, some very interesting expressions. In the Greek, variableness means no fickleness. No fickleness. What's fickle? Flaky. We all know the word flaky, and we probably have heard of flaky people. We may have actually been guilty of being flaky ourselves at one time or another, right? Not too long ago, I was having a discussion with a fellow who was an estate liquidator. He liquidates estates, and he advertises sometimes on Craigslist. And I say, well, I ask him one time, how's your sale going? You getting a lot of customers responding on Craigslist? And he looked at me and shook his head. He said, you know, some people are just flaky. He says, they call you up. They say they're coming over. You know, you make sure you're there at 5 o'clock, and they say they're coming at 5 o'clock. He says, and they never show up. They never call. They're just flaky. People tend to be undependable. But God is not flaky. He's not fickle. He's there. His creation is consistent. His promises are sure. Set our hearts on spiritual things. Think about the faithfulness of God. It's kind of interesting. James wrote this at a time when the other gods that were worshipped around them were the Roman gods, borrowed from the Greeks. And if you know anything about Greek and Roman gods, one thing you'll notice is that they are flaky and fickle. They had to be pleased all the time. Food offerings, their traditions and many of their fables about the gods of the Greeks taught that they battled each other and, you know, they were unfaithful to their mates and, you know, they were just a bunch of fickle gods. So he's saying, by contrast, there is no fickleness. Translated here, no variation with our God. Or shadow of turning. Again, another very interesting expression. In the Greek, it means obscuration or shadow or shading off. Or we might say there was no fake out. Some of you may have heard about a basketball player by the name of Steph Curry. Some people nodding their heads. Steph Curry moved into our town about 6 blocks from us not too long ago. He's a very good basketball player. Fairly short for the NBA. He's about 6'3", I think. And he's a very good shooter. And he has a play. He's such a good dribbler with either hand as a guard that he can come up to a defending player and he can do what is called a yo-yo dribble, which is he fakes one way and switches the ball in his hands and dribbles around the opposite direction and leaves the defender standing there. And he just goes by him and he goes to the basket and makes an easy layup. And they call it the yo-yo dribble by Steph Curry. He's a very good guard in the NBA, plays for Golden State Warriors, who won, you know, the NBA championship last year. He does this several times during the game. And, of course, the commentators who are calling the game, by the way, his dad, Del Curry, is one of the commentators for the Golden State Warriors. And he says, there he goes again with that yo-yo dribble, faking everybody out. Well, when it says here that there is no shadow of turning in verse 17, it means there's no faking you out. God is not going to fake you out. He's not going to say, you think the ball's here? Ha ha, fooled you, it's over here. I did the old yo-yo dribble and I dribbled around you. There's no sleight of hand with God. There's no faking you out. There's no saying, I'm going to do this, and then pulls back the promise very quickly and says, just joking. God is not that way. There is no variation, no fickleness, or shadow of turning with God. Something I think we should think about once in a while and meditate about how faithful God is, and that God, of course, is our example. Hebrews 13:8, I'm not going to turn there, but it says, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. In Malachi 3:6, God does not change. Let's, as we're considering this, thinking about setting our hearts on spiritual things, let's go to 1 Corinthians 1, verse 9. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 9. I like this expression. I always like these simple expressions to define God. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 9. God is faithful. I think he's proven that, as we read in James, by the creation itself. The same basics that all of us take for granted, the sun, the moon, and the stars. We all know we are the perfect distance from the sun. If we were a little closer, we'd all burn up. If we were just a few thousand miles further, we'd all freeze to death. It's just perfect. God is faithful to preserve his creation. God is faithful, by whom you were called into the fellowship of his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. So my first point is for us to set our heart on spiritual things and to talk about and to think about spiritual things. I thought it was a wonderful exercise we all went through in this interactive session that we had when we talked about spiritual things. We talked about our experiences of faith and how our faith was built through some of those things that we went through. Point number two. Through this process, we draw close to God. Point number two is draw close to God. Draw close to God. As was mentioned this morning, we do that through prayer, as it says in Luke 18, and not losing heart. Let's go to James chapter 4, verse 8. James chapter 4, verse 8. Draw close to God. Point number two. When we think about spiritual things, it naturally draws us close to God. James 4, verse 8. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. When we think about spiritual things, when we think about the greatness of God and his faithfulness, it will inspire us to more faithfulness. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. God doesn't want us to be hypocritical or double-minded. He wants us to draw close to him. There are various things that can cause us to draw closer to him. I know we had several examples in our little circle of people during the interactive part. And I think it's important for us to reflect sometimes on those times in our lives when we were forced through whatever circumstances to draw closer to God. Another example that I didn't want to use in the breakout because I was planning to use it now was when I was a young pastor. I'd been in the pastoring, I guess, in the ministry 6 years, 5 years. And I was running a church circuit in a little town called Chilliwack, British Columbia, and Surrey, British Columbia. And I would do Chilliwack in the morning on the Sabbath, and I'd do Surrey in the afternoon. And one of our deacons, his name was Terry Sykes, gave the sermonette in the morning. Terry was a man who owned his own print shop out in the town of Hope, of British Columbia, on the Fraser River. And it was a very small town, and he was the only printer in town, so he had a lot of business in his print shop. It was before the days of FedEx and Kinko's and all those little shops we have today. And Terry gave a very good sermonette in the morning, but he had a headache, so he left church early. And in the afternoon, I rushed off to the afternoon congregation and gave a sermon, and I got home. And that was the day before cell phones, but I got home, and there was a message on my phone, on my home phone. You see the little red light blinking, and I still remember. I picked up the phone, and it was another member from the Chilliwack Church who was on his way home, and he passed a car accident, a very serious car accident. And he called me and he said, Mr. Registrar, I passed a very serious car accident on the way home from church, and it looked like the Sykes car. He says, but I couldn't really tell. And the RCMP was waving us through, and he said, I've tried to call Terry several times at home and he doesn't answer the phone. And I'm very concerned. Well, I became concerned too at that point, and I began to think, okay, I called the RCMP and they didn't have any information. I began to call hospitals to see if anybody had been taken to the hospital. And I discovered that they had been taken to Chilliwack Hospital, and there was a serious accident. And the person who answered the phone said, well, are you part of the family or whatever? And I explained who I was, and she said, well, I think you better come to the hospital. And so I drove out to Chilliwack again. It's about maybe an hour from where I lived. And went into the hospital, and I was met there by a doctor, and he wanted to know who I was, and I explained who I was. And he said, well, I have some bad news for you. The Sykes were in a serious automobile accident, a head-on collision, and they have all been killed. It was Terry Sykes, our deacon, our deacon's wife, his wife, and they had two children, 9 and 12. And they were all killed in that automobile accident. Well, as you might imagine, it shakes your faith when you're in the face of that kind of a trial. And I was thinking about the extended family who were not in the church. And I was thinking about the congregation who deeply loved Terry and his family. And they were all very close in that small congregation. And then shortly thereafter, as I was sitting there just thinking about this whole thing in the waiting room at the hospital, the doctor came out to me again and he says, I've gotten a hold of the next of kin. And nobody wants to come and identify the people who've died. And they want to know if you will do that. Well, I didn't want to do that. Who would want to do that? But I felt, well, I don't want to put that burden on the family. And I'm here at the hospital, and I asked the doctor, I said, is that appropriate? He says, well, if you know them well enough. You're their pastor. He says, I want you to identify them. And, of course, that's the kind of experience you never forget. When you have to go into a morgue and identify four members of a family who've been in a very serious automobile accident, and, of course, that was the day before seatbelts. And it was very difficult in one case to actually identify the person. But I was able, from their body build and from what I knew of them, to recognize them and identify them. And then, of course, the family, because they were members of the church, asked me to do the funeral. And again, as you might imagine, the entire town came out for the funeral. It was a big funeral. I think 500 people or so there. It was early on in my ministry. It was one of the few funerals that I've done like that, where there's four coffins, two of them small. Sitting in front of you, and it was at that moment I realized that I wasn't as close to God as I should have been. I was young in my ministry, and I realized that I needed to draw closer to God. So I, of course, fasted before that funeral. And then after that funeral, I went on a personal campaign to visit every member of the congregation as soon as I could. Because the whole congregation was devastated by such a tragedy. And I did. And I will say that through that experience, I think our little congregation grew closer and our faith was deepened rather than having doubts in God. And our relationships were strengthened. Good came out of that tragedy. In the end, as a result of us all drawing close to God, I gave several sermons shortly thereafter about fasting and praying. I think it shook everybody up in the whole church. Everybody realized that the drive home from church could be the end of a life. It sobered everybody up, the entire congregation. As a result, all of us drew close to God. Sometimes tragedies do that for us, don't they? We hope none of us has to go through or experience a tragedy like that, even vicariously, to remind ourselves that we need to be close to God so that we can withstand the tests and trials as they come. And surely, as I am standing here before you, they will. Hopefully not that serious, but they will. So my second point is draw close to God. It will help prepare us for the trials that lie ahead. And finally, point number three, we must learn about faith from studying the scriptures and talking about faith. We learn about faith from studying the scriptures and talking about faith. We learn about faith from studying the scriptures and talking about faith. In Romans chapter 10 and verse 17. Romans 10 verse 17. You know, sometimes I've wondered why did God allow me to go through that experience? And then I realized hopefully it was to help others that I can tell about that experience. Like today. Romans 10:17. So then faith comes by hearing. By hearing stories like we heard during our interactive session this afternoon. And hearing, of course, hearing about God and faith in the scriptures by the word of God. We talk about it. We read about it. We study it. Learn about faith from studying the scriptures and talking about faith. I'd like to go briefly to Luke 17 where Mr. Franks took us this morning in that opening message for our young adult leadership weekend. Luke 17 verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 through 4 basically talk about offenses will come and Christ talked about forgiving people who offend us, and his advice in verse 4, if he sins against you seven times in a day returns to you saying, I repent, you shall forgive him. And the apostles were overwhelmed by this admonition in verse 5, and the apostles said, increase our faith. And that's what we're talking about here this weekend is, how do we increase our faith? Christ's answer to their request is very interesting. So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it will obey you. And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him, when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down and eat. But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink. Does he thank that servant because he did those things that were commanded of him? I think not. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. I want to take a little bit of an overview and focus a little differently than Mr. Franks did on this particular set of scriptures. First of all, we learned that our faith can be increased. Our faith can grow. A minister once told me, faith is like the tree, Dave. You have to water it with Bible study. You have to move the ground around a little bit like you would in a plant you have at home or in your garden or in your yard. You have to cultivate it. That's like talking about faith. And that faith tree can build. It can grow. It can get bigger and stronger. And that's what we're doing here this weekend is we're trying to grow our faith tree a little bigger, a little stronger. increase our faith. So faith does grow. Christ didn't contradict their request. He went on to explain, and I would like to focus on verse 10. We are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. In order to build faith, we have to go above and beyond what is expected. Not the minimum requirement of a Christian, but above and beyond what is expected. Just as God demonstrates His faithfulness to us through the creation, we must demonstrate faithfulness when we have opportunity through our family, through our brethren, through our co-workers, to be faithful people. If you practice faith, your faith tree is going to build. It's going to grow. Let's go back to Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, Hebrews 11:13, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland, not this homeland, but one to come, that is, the kingdom of God. It's an interesting verse, verse 13. Tells us that before this, talking about Sarah and Abraham, and beyond this, talking about Abraham and other faithful ones. In fact, this whole chapter is a good one. You know, we talk about drawing close to God and reading the scriptures, studying the scriptures, is a good one to start our own study on. I don't have the time to go through the examples of all these faithful men in scripture. We can do that apart from today. Think about the faithfulness of Abraham, who's called the father of the faithful, who believed. Verse 17 says, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, and believe you me, our faith will be tested. It will be. Offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed will be called. Concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in figurative sense. Then he talks about Isaac, and then Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses, and on it goes. It's just, it's one of the most inspiring chapters of the Bible. If you read it and think of the stories, maybe even hold your finger here and go back and refer to those stories. Point number three, learn about faith from studying the scriptures and discussing the experiences of faith. Let's go to Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, Romans 1:16. Romans 1:16. Paul wrote to the church at Rome, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Faith will make us confident in the gospel of Christ, not ashamed of it. For it is the power of God to salvation. What is the power of God to salvation? Not being ashamed, but being faithful. Having faith in that salvation. For everyone who believes, from the Jew first, and also for the Greek. Now verse 17. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Verse 17 has a very interesting expression here. From faith to faith. Some commentaries say from the beginning to the end. What it's talking about is levels of faith. It's talking about the growth of faith. When we first come into the church, we build our faith one step at a time. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and grows greater and greater and stronger and stronger. At first, we come to the point where we have to really believe there is a God, don't we? We're convinced of that. Then we have to believe that God, if He is a God, He created a manual by which we live. And we believe in the Word of God. That builds more faith. And then we believe if He gave us a Word, then He probably told us there's some things in here we should do. And we start doing those things, right? And God says, prove me. And we begin to prove God. And our faith now is on a third level. And then a fourth level. And then a fifth level. And we begin to do these things and we go, oh, I started tithing. I didn't think I could afford that. But God bless me. Abraham was the father of the faithful. That's what he did. And his faith built stronger and stronger and went to a higher and higher plateau, didn't it? From faith to faith. God is revealed from faith to faith. As we grow in faith from one level of faith to the next, we see God more clearly. That only undergirds and strengthens our faith. It is really an interesting cycle. God is revealed. The righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Faith. When our faith is tried, how will we respond? Will we look around and say, is there anybody else up there? Or will we put in the effort to increase our faith by setting our heart on spiritual things? Drawing close to God and studying about faithfulness in the scriptures and talking about faith. Brethren, if we do these things, Christ will find faith on the earth when He returns.